This past Wednesday morning, the monthly meeting of the National Area Interfaith Council, which I somehow find myself presiding over this year, was held over at the Anne Marie House in Hudson. Some of you probably know where that is, down to sort of the lower end of a whole road there. It's on the grounds of the Presentation of Mary Academy. The Anne Marie House was, I believe, for a long time, the convent where the nuns who taught at PMA lived. With that population greatly diminished, we were looking for some other uses for the facility, and it is now used by the Greater Nashua Interfaith Housing Network to provide short-term housing and meals for homeless families who are trying to get back on their feet. The purpose of our gathering last Wednesday was so that we could see the outcome of our efforts and what the contributions of a wide range of faith and interfaith communities in this Nashua area had brought forth in making it happen. And I was very impressed with how that whole program is set up, with its goal of getting these families back into mainstream society as soon as possible. Some of you may recall, I think it was back last fall, maybe a little before that, that we did a month of outreach collections on behalf of this effort, specifically to help them build a fence behind the Anne Marie House so that the children who were staying there with their families would have a place to play. There was also some kind of a wetlands issue involved that's rather complicated for me to explain, but there was an environmental component as to why they needed that fence there as well, and if it didn't get built, they weren't going to be able to open the facility. So we took up some money, as we do, for a few weeks, and bought them a fence. And so in the program that was offered at the Anne Marie Chapel last Wednesday, as they were telling the story about how this whole thing came to be and sort of celebrating its coming into existence, we were specifically thanked for providing that fence. I even went and checked it out. You know, there's the UU fence. And since many of you were among those who contributed your money towards that, I felt it only right and proper to thank you for your doing that this morning. I pass along their thanks to you. Well, a part of that morning's presentation is also given over, as you would think in a facility like that, a place like that, as to what some of the motivations were for putting such a thing in place as this, above and beyond the clear and present need for it. And among the various motivations cited, the admonition of Jesus to his listeners and followers to feed the hungry and shelter the needy. Now, as I said, this was an interfaith gathering and project. Not all present, not all who contributed were Christians. The IFC, I'm happy to say, has even recently expanded now to include a local Hindu community. But for those Christians involved, their ultimate motivation for putting this facility in place was because Jesus said this is the kind of thing you're supposed to do when it comes to relating to and caring about your fellow men and women. So through their religious lens, we built that fence for Jesus. And even if I don't totally share that perspective myself, I appreciate it. With some of the terribly disturbing things being done in the name of Jesus these days, I'm happy to contribute to an effort carried forth at least partly in his name to care for the homeless. So, what would Jesus do really? That's the question I am posing on this Palm Sunday, the Sunday which I have used for most of my years in the UU Parish Ministry to offer some of my thoughts on the life, on the meaning of the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth as I have come to understand it, the one whom our Christian sisters and brothers also call the Christ. Now, the quick and easy answer I could toss out that would, get us out of here right now would be no chance of that. Quick and easy answer would be to say we don't know because we really don't know who Jesus in any historical sense was. What the New Testament Gospels give us is an image or a portrait of a person whom the Gospel writers had already come to assume was a uniquely divine manifestation of God. So we see this quasi-historical figure through their lens. The Gospels are not biographies, certainly not in the sense that we understand historical biography today. They're more like theological tracts written to establish that Jesus was also the Christ, the Son of God, and the founder of the religion that was forming in his name. In fact, it was one of his earliest followers, Saul of Tarsus, later known as St. Paul, who would cast him as a savior, whose death atoned for the sins of humanity. And I think this is really why I get a little bemused, I guess is the best word for it, at some of the debates and discussions and arguments that continually seem to crop up about who Jesus actually was and what he really did, and did such and such really happen, and did he really say that, etc., etc. We see, for example, some of the more orthodox Christian communions right now feeling they have to mount some kind of a rebuttal to Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code for what it suggests about Jesus' ongoing earthly life. Now, the last time I checked, that book was still being listed in the fiction column of the Evangelist. And the author himself has never made any other claim but that, so I'm not quite sure where all the fuss is. Then, just this past week, a science professor at Florida State University offered a meteorological explanation of how Jesus really could have walked on the water on the Sea of Galilee. Something about the meteorological conditions being ripe at that time for an ice flow that he was really balancing himself on. Well, anyway. In a somewhat more serious vein, over the past couple of days, we've seen the reports of the unearthing or discovery of something like about a 1,700-year-old Gospel of Judas document that purports to explain his side of the story. I actually thought Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber did a pretty good job of that about 30, 40 years ago in Jesus Christ Superstar. But according to Elaine Pagels, who is a very esteemed New Testament scholar, she's a professor of religion at Princeton University, she says this Gospel of Judas is but one of several texts on the life and teachings of Jesus, known collectively as the Gnostic Gospels, that were rejected as heretical when the New Testament canon was being put in place. Very fascinating stuff, not exactly where I'm going today, except just to add one more thing to this list. A couple years ago, as you may remember, it was this Mel Gibson movie that was generating all the buzz about Jesus. The curious thing for me about these kinds of news stories is their timing. These are stories, accounts, and controversies. They always seem to surface right during the Easter season. I think they're where they were the rest of the year. It seems like they become one more part of our cultural media cycle, you know, and if Easter's coming up, we've got to do some Jesus kinds of things. So that seems to be the way it happened. It's all rather interesting and tantalizing, and I say good for Dan Brown that he doesn't have to worry about whether an English teacher's pension is going to be enough for him to retire on. He's going to do fine. But here is the frustrating part for me. We seem to have such an obsession about who Jesus really was and what he really did, or did this or that aspect of his life really happen, that it seems like his message almost gets lost in the shuffle. As I already said, what we know about the messenger is shrouded in a veil of legend and myth and lore. And while trying to see behind that veil is fascinating, and it's something I like to do myself from time to time, it really is the message, more so than the messenger, that we should be seeking to understand. Especially since it is a message that really transcends the bounds of any one religious faith tradition or belief system. Some of you might remember, a couple of months ago, I did my children's story down here, and I actually used this book called The Parallel Sayings of Jesus and Buddha. Picked it up when I was on my sabbatical back in January. Really fascinating piece of work. This is the kind of text that actually grabs my attention more so than those that speculate about who Jesus was. I'm going to read just a few lines from the introduction to this book to give us a framework for where I want to go for the remainder of this sermon. Written by someone I've referred to here before, Dr. Marcus Borg. He's a liberal Christian theologian, professor of religion at Oregon State University. I was privileged to take a course to him from through the Graduate Theological Union several years ago. This is what it says. Jesus and Buddha were teachers of a world-subverting wisdom that challenged and undermined conventional ways of seeing and believing in their time and every time. They taught a way or path of transformation. Despite language and imagery, the way taught by the Buddha and the way taught by Jesus strongly resemble one another. In their wisdom teaching, I see no significant difference. How does one account for it? Close quote. I really like that phrase, world-subverting wisdom. I'll come back to that a few times. Now, while Buddha lived some 500 years prior to Jesus, Dr. Borg actually discounts the idea that Jesus was simply borrowing from Gautama. His explanation, which I accept, is that they each had a kind of a transformative experience that put them in touch with certain timeless truths and knowledge and wisdom that have always been, that have long been present and that called humanity to its more elevated self. In the Jesus stories, he gets his wisdom while spending time alone in the wilderness. In the Buddhist stories, Gautama gets the message while sitting under a Bo tree. They each then, as their stories or legends continue to be told, gather unto themselves a small group of followers and then deliberately place themselves outside the conventional workings of their society and the ways of life in their respective societies, so they can then, from that vantage point, question and challenge many of the assumptions that that society is operating under. And while Jesus came from the working class sector of his society, his father, as the story goes, was a carpenter, and while Buddha came from the wealthy and ruling class of his society, each of them, after they had this transforming experience, got this timeless message, each of them chose primarily to identify with and cast their lots with the outcasts of their respective societies. Each of them mostly took their message and their ministry to those who had been beaten out to the edges of the society of their day. They took it to the people who didn't quite fit in, to persons who, for one reason or another, had become alienated from the mainstream of their society and their culture. This is why in that Beat Face of God book I did last fall, I wasn't just being flip when I said that I regarded Jesus as a proto-beat. I really think he was. So, for all the similarities, though, the Borg cites between the teachings of Jesus and Buddha, the major difference between them, he points out, is that Jesus took a more confrontational approach to the powers and societal structures of his day than Buddha did. The Jesus figure of the New Testament is actually more socially and politically engaged than is the Buddha. Well, Martin Borg is an academic. I appreciate all the scholarly work he's done to give us a better understanding of this person. But I also take some of my cues along this line from my American folk hero and advocate for simple justice, Woody Guthrie. Now, among the hundreds upon hundreds of songs that Woody cranked out in his lifetime was one that he simply titled Jesus Christ. I've got a couple of verses here which I will not sing. I'll read them. But maybe you can imagine if you're here, you know, Woody Guthrie singing that sort of flat, nasal, twangy kind of Midwestern voice that Bob Dylan later came along and emulated. Anyway, this is Woody Guthrie, a couple of verses. Jesus Christ was a man who traveled through the land, a hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your money to the poor, but they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus came to town, all the working folks around believed what he did say. But the bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Last two lines, written in that same Woody Guthrie style, simply say, if Jesus was to preach what he preached in Galilee, they would lay poor Jesus in his grave. Actually, it's if Jesus were to preach, but we've got to cut Woody Guthrie a little slack here with his English. Anyway, what would Jesus do, really? As I've been stressing all along, I can only answer the question based on the veiled portrait the New Testament Gospels give us and what others, from academia to working class folk writer, song hero, have taken from that portrait. And here's what I get. I don't know how he'd specifically do it if he were holding forth here and now, but the essence of the teachings of Jesus constitute a fundamental challenge to how we define and understand and pursue success and power. I think Borg nailed it pretty well when he said that both Jesus and Buddha taught world-subverting wisdom. So think about it from that angle. What world-subverting wisdom would a figure like Jesus offer to our current ethos of success that equates endless and largely mindless acquisition with the attainment of the good life? One of the more intriguing of the Jesus stories for me is the one called The Story of the Rich Young Man. The main character in this story is a first century Galilean version of a yuppie, I guess. Kind of what it sounds like. He's on his way up, everything breaking his way, good career track in front of him, all of that. And he seeks out Jesus for a little advice. You sound like a pretty smart guy. What do you think I need to be doing with my life that I'm not doing already? The answer he gets is, sell all you have, give it to the poor, and come join my little wandering band of hobos here. Which was enough to send a guy on his way. Probably wondering why he never bothered to even raise the question with a head case like Jesus. Now, I don't know if Jesus meant for this guy to take him literally or not, because you've got to remember that most teachers of wisdom spoke in metaphors more than they spoke on a literal level. They tended to speak metaphorically and then let their listeners try to figure out what it is they were actually trying to say. That's the way most teachers at this level operate. I think what Jesus was trying to say in this story is that if you try to define success according to the conventional norms of your society, you're going to come up short, way short. It is what you pour out from yourself. This is what Dick Gilbert was saying in that meeting I shared earlier. It is what you pour out from yourself rather than what you pull into yourself that will save you and what you'll be remembered for. I think this will be his primary challenge to us. Define what you really mean by success before you decide how you're going to pursue it. And then there's the question of power. The Jesus figure of the New Testament challenge the whole notion of power as dominion, or of power as the means of forcing one's will upon another. He does not appear to be an anarchist. He apparently recognizes the realms of societal life that rightly belong to the civil authority, give to Caesar what is rightfully his, as he put it. And he did not directly take on the established authority of his day, so much as he tried to exemplify another kind of power. The power of example. The power of persuasion. The power of witness that comes by simply standing with and for the dispossessed and disenfranchised of that world, of the world, and then from that vantage point, speaking truth to the more worldly forms of power and authority. Didn't divorce himself from the world, stood apart from those workings of it to give his message. This was the very same kind of power that Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King chose to exercise. It got both of them killed, just as it did Jesus. The Palm Sunday story, which when I thought about it, decided it should really be called either Palm Sabbath or Palm Passover. There was no Sunday at that time. But the Palm Sunday story appears to be about a popular uprising that Jesus' presence kicked off during a Passover celebration in Jerusalem, which so frightened the authorities they had him killed along with a few other poor souls who were slated for execution at the time. And the most intriguing piece of this story for me is the refusal of Jesus to resort to force or violence himself, as well as his forbidding his followers to do so. Maybe he knew that he had his own kind of power that would outlast both his earthly life and the Roman rule. And he was right. The Roman authorities executed numerous leaders of popular uprisings when they were at the height of their power. But the one we still talk about is the one who gave up his life in order to question the very legitimacy of their power itself. I can only wonder how this Jesus figure would challenge the use of power by our world's most powerful nation today. Or as a bumper sticker I picked up last summer put it, who would Jesus bomb? Now, I got that. I picked that thing up in the bookstore, a very subversive location, namely the bookstore of a Dominican monastery. Make one more passage for it before I wrap this up. He points out that neither Jesus nor Buddha intended to found a religion in their respective names. Buddha taught from within the context of the Hinduism of his day, just as Jesus taught from within the context of the Judaism of his time. Well, I'm not knowledgeable enough to speak to this from the Buddhist side of the aisle, but I have to wonder what Jesus would make of the religion that is now carried forth in his name. There is much I feel that would in fact gladden him. The compassion and the caring for those he termed the least of these, but has done in his name, would, I am guessing, be heartening to him. The advocacy efforts for what our own Unitarian Universalist principles call justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and our striving after the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, in these efforts, I believe, Jesus would see them as a continuation of his teachings and his efforts, whether they are done in his name or not. In fact, I rarely seriously doubt that he would care whether he got credit for these kinds of things so long as they got done. At the same time, and I speak only for myself now rather than speculating about the mind of Jesus, at the same time, it does boggle my mind that a particular segment of the religion created in the name of this simple teacher of subversive wisdom has been appropriated by some of those who are responsible for creating in this nation the disparity between the wealthy and the powerful and the dispossessed, such as we have seldom seen in our history, and who have taken us into a needlessly horrible war that is progressively alienating our country from the very world community that Jesus himself envisioned. I think in so doing, they have indeed laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Thank you, Woody Guthrie. But, as I'll be saying next time, I believe in resurrection of a kind. I believe, as do Christians and many non-Christians alike, in keeping alive this Jewish Galilean prophet's subversive wisdom. While I no longer adhere to most of the doctrines that have come to constitute the religion about Jesus, doctrines that he never promulgated himself, I still find much that is worthy in the religion of Jesus. And that is what I have tried to share a little bit of this morning, the religion of Jesus. I still seek ways of incarnating, of putting into flesh and blood, the subversive wisdom of this proto-beast. Our own faith tradition has its roots in those very teachings. With whatever names we may invoke, with whatever names we may set aside, we remain a community of faith committed to carrying this wisdom forward. So let's sing together a closing hymn, Summer 276, O Young and Fearless Prophet.